Welcome to tonight's Civic Forum. Tomorrow, my life, orphans in post-genocide Rwanda. My name is David Scobie. I'm the director of the Harwood Center for Community Partnerships here at Bates. The Harwood Center is the host of tonight's discussion and the convener of the larger Civic Forum series. Our center's mission is to weave civic engagement into the Bates education by coordinating and catalyzing community-based learning and research, community service and volunteerism, and environmental stewardship. And one important part of that mission is to convene discussions like this that explore public affairs and help to advance a culture of democratic conversation and reflection. The Civic Forum series plays an especially important role in part of that mission. The series brings to campus distinguished speakers, advocates, activists, scholars, experts, to deliberate on policy, political, and civic issues of significance to the Bates community, the Maine community, and beyond. Tonight's Civic Forum carries us to that world beyond Maine. It concerns the Tutsi genocide in Rwanda and the reconstruction of lives and communities in post-genocide Rwanda. And yet there couldn't be a more immediate and important claim on our attention and our civic imagination than this issue. We are extremely lucky here on the Bates campus to have our friend and colleague, Professor Alex Doge-Roth of the French Department, to help us understand and engage both the events of 1994 in Rwanda and the efforts to deal with them and transcend them in today's Rwanda. Alex's own scholarship concerns the testimonies of those who lived through the genocide, and he has enlisted as a citizen scholar in both understanding and advancing memory, healing, and community building. And through him, we're doubly fortunate that he's brought to Bates one of his own collaborators in those projects, Bert Kaitesi, a survivor and witness to the events in Rwanda, a writer and an educator. Professor Doge-Roth will begin tonight's forum by giving us some context from the recent history of Rwanda, and then he will introduce our honored speaker. Let me simply say that we are delighted and grateful to welcome her. Before I ask Alex to come up, let me offer a few words of thanks and a few words about our format. The Civic Forum series is the brainchild of my colleague at the Harwood Center, Peggy Rotundo, and I want to thank her for organizing tonight's panel. Two other Harwood Center colleagues, Brenda Pelletier and Kristen Cloutier, have been tireless and gracious in organizing this event and Bert's visit. And finally, let me thank the Office of Communications and Media Relations at Bates for helping spread the word, and also Maine Public Broadcasting Network, which plans to broadcast an edited version of tonight's forum, as it does with nearly all our civic forums, on its program Speaking in Maine. After Alex and Bert speak, there will be time for questions, answers, discussions with you in the audience. And if you do speak, as I hope you will, please touch base with either me or Peggy at the end to sign a permission form so that we actually may include your exchange in the MPBN broadcast. Finally, and most of all, I want to thank Alex Doge-Roth, for without him, none of this would have happened. Let me ask you to join me in thanking him and inviting him up to the podium.
Good evening. So what I would like to do is just to quickly give you some very brief summary of the history that led to the genocide, just because Bert's Kaitesi story happens in a broader history. It's in dialogue and confrontation with it, and so in order to be able then to ask questions and getting answers and making more sense and putting into perspective her own journey. So that's what I would like to do briefly here. So first of all, where's Rwanda? So here you can see where it is. Rwanda is also a beautiful country. As well. So also, I like to say that at the beginning because it's important that to reduce either people nor countries to history that happened in those places, and cultures and societies are always more complex than the events because of which we know them, at least here. Here's the city and the different main cities of... So maybe also that will help you to locate some of the places maybe Bert is going to refer to. So here are the three main periods of Rwanda's history that we can summarize as the pre-colonial period and then the arrival of the German in 1899 until independence in 62, and then post-colonial and independence period. So what I would like to stress here is that in the pre-colonial period, so Rwanda is a kingdom that extends from 15th, 16th century on. It's a kingdom that was broader than its current borders that were defined at the conference, the Berlin Conference at the end of the 19th century. Because of that, all the people who live in Rwanda share the same language, the same culture, the same religion. This is important to keep in mind because of what will happen later through the introduction of a colonial reading of Rwanda's history. And this explains why also there are people who speak Kinyarwanda, that you can find the Tutsi and Hutu people in Burundi, in the eastern part of Congo, and in Uganda as well. And those are ethnographic pictures of the kingdom with the importance of the cattle and the cow, which is one of the main assets in Rwanda's pre-colonial and early colonial economy and still nowadays. So let me jump then to the colonial gaze and its implications. What happened when the German lost the control of Rwanda after World War I? Then Belgium was given the administration of the country, and the Belgian administrators were mostly coming from Congo, where there are very many ethnicities, and so they were trying to figure out how the Rwandan society was functioning, and then they tried to identify what are the different ethnies which are present within Rwanda. And so they introduced in a reading that there were Bantu people that they broadly identified as Hutus who were the natives of the country. And then a very small minority, about 1% of the population, that they identified as Pygmy, called Twa. And then in the reading, they found a kingdom that was very well organized, where there was a very small Tutsi minority that was had the hold on the kingdom and the power. And so they identified those not only as social elites, but as ethnic group that was far more superior than all the others. And it was natural that they were in power. And then they identified this group as the Tutsi, as being cattle owners who were coming down from Abyssinia and who invaded and conquered and took over the kingdom of Rwanda, or this place of Rwanda. So what happened then is Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa are social identifiers and markers that existed in pre-colonial Rwanda. So it's not that Belgium introduced those terms, but what happened, and here I'll make it very short, is that those were social categories. So basically a Hutu could become a Tutsi. It was not easy, so it took various means, a marriage, or you had to do certain acts that would then benefit the kingdom, and you were then promoted socially. But there was social mobility that was possible. What happened then is that those social categories got ethnicized. And in the 30s, the Belgian then issued an identity card on which there was not only the mention that people were Rwandan, but that they were Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa, and that those this identity from there on would be passed down the generation through the father. So you move from social categories to a centralized conception of identity through which you cannot escape from. And so this is a key step because it's one of the major preconditions of the implementation of genocide, where you get killed for who you are and not what you do. So then in the 50s, the Tutsi, so then the Belgian ruled Rwanda indirectly through a Tutsi minority, through which they gave a lot of privileges, access to education, social advantages, but it was only a minority of the Tutsi identified population. So, and because it's important to keep in mind that Rwanda was mostly, for most of the tension, were clanic and were not at all played before the Belgian arrived through those categories of Tutsi, Twa, and Hutu. Within the same clan, you had the three social positions that were present. And so in the 50s, the Tutsi minority that was favored by the Belgian, was then claiming independence, like it was happening in many numbering countries and colonies. And there, the Belgian shifted totally their allegiance and little by little formed a Hutu elite, especially through the church. And this Hutu elite then was promoted as being now the natives, the majority of the people that needs to be freed and protected from the Tutsi elite who wants to rule them. And so that's how the Parme Hutu was founded, and Grégoire Kayibanda was then the first president of Rwanda in 62, when the country became independent. And here, unfortunately, there was this historical moment that was lost because it was still the same paradigm that prevailed in post-colonial or during colonial Rwanda, because it was just an inversion of who was in power. But the way identity was constructed was strictly the same. It was still a centralized identity that helped to stigmatize a certain category of people in this case. And in the 60s also, you have the first big wave of exodus and exiles, people who go to Burundi, Congo, and Uganda in the 60s, because there was persecution of the Tutsis that occurred during this independence movement. And then in 73, you've got a coup where Habyarimana takes power and replaces Kayibanda. And this was purely a Hutu internal affair between Kayibanda, who was from the south, and Habyarimana, who was from the north. And here again, the Tutsi served as scapegoat to what was going on and were persecuted politically, and you have another wave of people who leave in exile. But here, what I want to say is that there's not Hutu is not a homogeneous social group that constitutes 80% of the population here. Then the Tutsis who went into exile, and among them there will be Kagame, who is now the president of Rwanda, so created a liberation army, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, who attacked in the end of the 90s from Uganda, the northern part of Rwanda. And it could have ended there. Did the French not intervene and protect? So here you have Mitterrand and Habyarimana in the bottom of the picture here. So if the French didn't intervene, there's great chances that the Rwandan Patriotic Front would have taken over Kigali and things would have been different. I don't know if they would have been for the better, but different for sure. And so then from there starts a very nasty propaganda, since you are in a situation of civil war, where all identified Tutsi people within the country are associated as being either informants, spies, traitors that work for the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and you have a revival of all the ideology that was also then produced in the 50s. Then coming, so the international community also played a role. There was then in 93 the introduction of multipartism in Rwanda, and on April 6, 94, then Habyarimana's plane is shut down, and so that then starts the genocide here. So at the same time, what I want to also stress out is that this genocide was not a spontaneous act. So often you find a lot of narrative that starts with the shutting down of the presidential plane, but of this event of this magnitude are very well planned by state. So you had lists that were generated, you had like rehearsal in certain regions in 92 and 93. The radios broadcast like RTLM was then created 3 years before the genocide, and then there are a lot of things that are put into place. And so the first people who were killed in Kigali after the plane was shut down were Hutu who opposed the Habyarimana's views or the Hutu power extremist. And Hutus here, which were, to so to speak, the internal opposition within the Hutu group, were the first people killed in Kigali before Tutsi were killed. So about 1 million people were killed between April 7 and mid-July 94. And so now, if you go to Rwanda, so there are various memorials that have been erected. So there's the whole memorialization of the genocide exists and is an issue. Bert Kaitesi's book is one piece of the memorialization process here. And here again, the reading of the past, the reading of history are very sensitive topics. For instance, it's only, I think, next year or beginning of next year that the first history book is going to come out since 94, because how do you teach history in this context? Here is our views from Kigali's nowadays. Then some traditional reading. Macy's, you can promote. You can buy them. There we go. So coffee, tea. Those are various industries that have helped to rebuild the country. And also, the genocide generated about 200,000 orphans. Bert Kaitesi is one of them. And in May of this year, was during the short term, so I went with 13 students, and Bert Kaitesi was my co-leader, co-host in Rwanda. So we spent 3 weeks there doing oral testimonies and gathering various perspectives about how those orphans attempt to rebuild their lives. And so here are some of the places. So maybe we can leave this, since certain people will recognize themselves. So Bert Kaitesi has already many friends at Bates, as we were walking along the campus, so I think I've never been stopped as frequently as I was walking with her and eating at Commons. And so it's a great pleasure to have her here. And so she wrote a book at the beginning of this year, Tomorrow My Life. And this was a five-year-long process. There are not many people and survivors who have succeeded or had the chance, because it takes both internal and external circumstances to succeed in this endeavor. And so we are very fortunate to have her here, and she will share then with us some facets of her trajectory. So the book is not translated yet in English, but it's something that is in the beginning of a process. And let me just say that, so Berthe Kaitesi was 15 years old in 94, and that in 2001, with her siblings, she joined an association in Kigali called Tubeho, which means let's live. And it's an association where about more than 300 orphans live in reconstituted families. And so that was one important place where she was then able also to find some stability. And in 2004, thanks to her brilliant studies, then she had the opportunity to come to Canada to do a master's degree in education. And she focused on the school, for the resilience of the orphans within the school system. So how come that some orphans are able to succeed academically while others don't. And so she was trying to find what kind of factors, both in their personal trajectories or sociologically, could shed some light on those discrepancies. And currently she is a PhD student at the University of Ottawa, pursuing her research in education and trying to study, I guess, people like me and also the students who came with me, since what she is interested is not to focus solely on people like her who are witnesses who testify, but also how people who go to Rwanda or who meet survivors are changed by this encounter. So please join me to welcome Berthe Kaitesi.
I'm going to use this one. Yeah. This afternoon I was at Alex's classroom, and students asked me some questions, and I would love to begin my speech with those questions. One was really important and was also challenged to me. It was, what are you doing here? And also, how I see the world after experience. After experiencing the genocide. And after that, I was thinking, yes, if it was not because of genocide, I will not be here today. And while I was writing my testimonies, it was because also of genocide. I'm not sure if it was not for genocide, I could be a writer today. And what is a genocide? A word which is not existed in my language, in my mother tongue. I'm not sure if I really do know what is a genocide. Even if I experienced it, I'm also learning about it. And I will always try to understand. And I'm not sure if I will ever understand one day. I'm not sure, but when you were 15 years old, and when something happened, and you do know what is happening, really. You are just killed, but you don't know why. It is just because you born. And after that, what relationship to have with life? It is not the focus of my book, and I was this afternoon thinking about the title of my book. The big part of the book is about the past. It is about my past. And the title is Tomorrow. What is tomorrow for me? I'm not sure. Maybe we'll make it together. Let me now try to share with you what was a genocide for me. Sometimes I say genocide was not really too bad for me, but it was. But I say it was not too bad where I compare my own story of genocide with other stories I heard every day in the aftermath of genocide. At the same time, a miracle, but at the same time, a lucky one among survivors. While the genocide began, I had a chance to not be at my own home with my parents. It was during the vacation, Easter vacations, and I was somewhere else in a convent. And at 7 April in the morning, there were a priest who was giving a mass ceremony, and he told us the president have been killed yesterday night. Even if I didn't understand more about what was going on, I remember that I say, oh my God, that is the end. I don't know why. Today, why did I say that at that time? And after that day, after that morning of 7 April, the superior of the convent had more phone calls from outside, and all the phone was about killings. I was thinking to my dad, who was 1 week before arrested by Interahamwe, who was not yet the killer, but who were the killer for during the genocide. I remember that my mom and my brother, we went to where my dad were arrested, and my mom gave some money, and we get home with dad. So because of that experience, I'm not sure if my dad will escape. But I was protected. I still there to April 21, but without having news from my family. And that date of April 21 is a fundamental debt for me of genocide experience. I remember it was in afternoon. And one nun who was Hutu and who was the superior came in the kitchen where I was with two others, nuns, and told me, you know, you have to tell everyone to found Haydn because the killers are here now. But before he came to tell me that, one among the two nuns I was with asked me a question. She asked me, "Bert, do you believe that we will survive?" And I told to him, "Maybe we have to hope." And when the nun told me, "Go and ask to everyone to find a hiding, I ran, and it was a big space. And I thought, "Oh, found a hiding, the curers are there." But I didn't really have time to find a hiding. And one killer was at me. And I begin to talk to that killer, "You know, I'm not a Tutsi. I was just here for vacation. I'm not from this area. I am from Chibuye. I was invited things to just try to tell to her I'm not Tutsi. I don't want to be killed." And he told me, "Come, we will explain that after." And when we arrived to the, I don't know how to say it in English, la porte de sortie. Sorry? Exit door, I found that there are many people I was with who were founded from their hiding, and they were on their knee. And I joined them, but I was just trying to say, "Oh, don't kill us." But they were on their knee, and they were like this. And in front of them, they were a killer with a gun. I was thinking, "My God, now we are going to die right here." But he didn't kill us. They told us to go in the bus, which was outside of the excited door. The nun who was trying to protect us and who was a Hutu hadn't have to go with us in the bus. They put us in the bus for a cemetery. And while going in the bus, I tried to not go in the bus. But I didn't have a choice to not go in the bus. I went in the bus with other Tutsi, and with that nun who was a Hutu and who hadn't to be killed. In the bus, and it is also an important moment, it is a moment where I found that victims of genocide are really very, very alone. We were in the bus, and the destination was a cemetery. And we were again in life. And as you know, people don't be conducted to the cemetery before they leave. But we are in life, and we were conducted at the cemetery. But Hutu were outside. The market was functioned, and I saw many people everywhere. Only Tutsi had to be killed. Before we arrived at the cemetery, one killer told to the nun who was a Hutu, "Why are you in the bus? You don't have to be in the bus, because you are a Hutu and your brother is a soldier and a colonel, you don't have to be with these Tutsi, but she told to them, you know, you are going to kill innocent people. If you kill them, kill me too. While at the cemetery, I heard a name of one killer, and while at the cemetery, I took his hands, I took first the hands of the nun. I was thinking maybe they will not kill her. And while at the cemetery, I go out to the bus and I take the hands of the nun, but she left my hands while other killers begin to kill people who were with me, with us. And I took the hands of one killer, the driver of the bus in which we were. One image which will never leave my mind, it is an image of a 13 years old man who tried to escape. He tried to run, but killers ran after him and took him, and they had machetes. And while they were walking, they were also killing him. He was among two killers, and all the two killers were cut where they want while they were walking with him. Other people who were with me, and among those, the one who asked me before, do you think we will survive, were killed by a gun. More than 13 persons had been killed there, 20 in front of me. And while there are other people who came just to see how Tutsi are being killed, like when you go to a football match or something else. And among those, I recognized a classmate for my primary school. They were a kid for 2 years old, and their parents were killed there. And the killer who take my hands told me, go and take that child and go back in the bus. So I took the child and I went back in the bus. And I go back where I was with the killers. On my road to went back home, one killer who is now in Arusha, Tanzania, asked the other one who helped me to escape, why she's here? And he told to him, you know, she lies that she's not Tutsi. And he told to him, stop the bus. I have to kill her too. But the driver didn't stop the bus. And he brought me with the young kid where I were. While there, I saw that we were just few survivors. A day after, we were not really far from Congo, but during the genocide, distance are very, very large. It was like 5 minutes to go to Congo from there we were, but we do not do it before the killers came. So that is how I experienced the genocide. But that is not the only, it is like my physics, but in my life. My parents were killed during the genocide. And I learned that in the after. When I were at a secondary school, I met someone who told me, do you know your parents were killed in front of our house? Your dad with machetes and your mom was beaten to death. While I was young, I lived some years with my grandmother. And I left her house when I was 9. And there, I had many cousins. I had an uncle who used to be for me like a father. I had aunts. And before genocide, I was asked to my parents, I want to go back. I left him when my grandmother died. I go back home, but it was far from where I used to live with my grandmother. And I was always talk to my father and mom, I want to go back and visit my uncle, visit my aunts, saying my classmates for primary school, my cousins. But they all died in the genocide. I don't know where. I lost also my two grand sisters who were twins. Till now we are looking where. Maybe my team from Tigari, they remember about that story. And around me, there are many survivors. Me, I had the chance to have my siblings. We are 8 in our family. But there are some survivors who are just alone. And they had all families. And how to be alone in the world where you had many people before, where you were surrounded by friends, by neighbor, by family, and then everything changed, everything is destroyed, and you have to apply, you have to learn how to be in a world which refused you just because you were born. That was a center of my book, somehow. As I didn't found where my cousins, I didn't have a chance to accompany my parents. My dad and my mom, my sisters, but they had names. They had faces. And in my mind and my life, I know those names I knew the faces, which I will forget probably. So all the time I was thinking, what can I do for trying to give them a dignity, to say that they existed, even not now. That is, was one among a goal for writing the book. But in after genocide, I was 15. My young brother was four years old. And many other children were also in our situation because of genocide. And then the genocide for us didn't end while the killings took end. We experienced also the consequences of genocide. Materially, emotionally, we were down. And many people still down. I'm not sure if I am up, even if I am up in front of you. And it was also the second goal. I was trying to say, trying to show what is a life after a genocide. But there were another goal also, to say that even if we were alone, there are small people who were with us, like that nun who died at the cemetery. She was a Hutu, and she hadn't to die. But she told to the curers, if you are killing these innocent people, kill me too. And she died there, and I was there. I witnessed it. And my goal was also to say that it is possible to act. I'm not sure if I will be able to act like she did, but I can say it because I saw it. In the aftermath, also, if I am in front of you, it is not, how to say, hazard. It is not, there is some chance, but not only the chance. There is my own work, but not only my own work. I was helped by several people, and in my book, the other goal was to say thank you to those people, and from them, to say to other people, if you try to help out, you can change the world of survivors. If you didn't intervene, if we were alone, you can help us to not stay alone. You can help us to go forward. That is was the other goal while writing my book. I think it is the summary. So now I'm open to the questions. Thank you.
Feel free to ask questions. And the mic just record your question. I'm not going to amplify it.
My question, I'm just looking at the efforts that have been put in place to bring, like, to integrate people in Rwanda. And I'm just looking at, have you been to Rwanda maybe like more after this, and what is the interaction now between the Tutus and the Hutus? Like, what efforts are there? Like, what do you see in terms of the relationships between perpetrators and the victims? Thank you.
You know, there's now 5 years I'm not in Rwanda. I am with you now, and it will not be easy to say what is going on right now. But before I left Rwanda, I saw that, you know, it is stranger, but it is true. There is no choice. People are living together. And while you are living together in a small country, you don't have any choice. For me, in my point of view, I think we are a sacrificed generation. And when I say we, it is we as survivors. I am talking in the name of myself and survivors. I cannot also say everything in name of survivors. We experience different things, and we are, our views of our experience are very different. I escaped because of a cure. There are some survivors who because of some people errors. But there are some survivors who never had anyone to help out during the genocide. So the different categories cannot have same view. If I think about that nun who gave her life for my life, I cannot see all Hutus as killers. But I have a friend who escaped alone. He is now in Switzerland, and he wrote a book, which is, the title is Genocide. I don't know how to say it in English.
Genocided.
Yeah, genocided. I know that in his view, all Hutus are killers. And he can't stay in Rwanda either now. But I can now, and I have friends who are Hutu. So interactions are different. But the approach of the government is reconciliation, is forgiveness. Yeah, that is what it means. I'm very sorry to kill your language.
Thank you so much for your insights. I'd like to learn something about the reconstituted families that was mentioned, Tubeho, and that kind of work that you're doing. Is
that clear? Tu as compris la question?
I think so. Mm-hmm. It is about children household. Mm-hmm. It became now slowly difficult to give a response. In the aftermath of a genocide, many children became parents of themselves. Even if they were in orphanage, they were alone. And There are others who were in the street. There are others who were in families and who were not in good families. There are some families who maltreated. I don't know if it is not
abused.
Yeah, who abused some orphans. And in my experience with my siblings, we passed some years, 4 years in orphanage. And I didn't really like the life in orphanage, and I was always thinking, how can we get out and be in a normal life? We were also in different families. But while doing my master's degree among Tubeho with children, other children household, I learned that we were many in the same conditions. And what was that conditions? That is what is really hard for me to explain. It is an experience I want just to put behind me. Yeah, it is just to have 17 years old and to have 4 siblings or 5 or some cousins, and you have to help them. So you begin to be a kind of parents, and your identity is like cut in different parties. You are not a sister, you are not only a brother, you are a father. Yeah, it is a huge identity. But for those siblings also, you are not really, even you are parents of themselves, but also they are parents of themselves because you are not really their parent. Yeah, it is a challenging situation. But I'm not sure if I respond the well on your question. Yeah.
I know that you're doing your PhD here. Do you have any desire to go back? Rwanda.
What is the question?
To return to Rwanda. Do you want?
For visit, not for stay for okay. Now. Maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. Yes, David.
Bert, I was really struck by one of the first things you said, that there was no word for genocide in your native language. And I wonder what words you used to make sense of what was happening to you, either when you were younger or in your own native language. If you didn't have the idea of genocide, what were the ideas that you used to explain it to yourself?
I think it is genocide is something which puts you out of the world. I don't know. Yeah, it's an event which is put out you in the world, and not only when it's happening, but all the time. No.
Do you think that the courts in Arusha are effectively punishing those, or it's more of like a symbolic gesture? Okay. If the courts in Arusha, Tanzania, mm-hmm. that are currently going on, if you think that they're actually punishing people, or if it's more symbolic?
Yeah, as you said, for me it is symbolically a good thing, but in the case of Rwanda, people who were implicated are so many. They are millions of people. The majority were implicated in a genocide, and how to punish all people in the country. You know, those who were not killing were indirectly, you know, it is like in Germany, how to see that people are going to a destination of relief and you are not saying anything. So everyone was accomplice in some kinds, not those who tried to help out. They are just a small minority, as I said, who tried to help out. But the majority are complice. So how to punish those who are at the top level, those who made the plan of genocide, those who executed, and those who were there not... how to say that? Yeah, the idea was like, okay, for them. If they didn't say no, it is because they were okay with the idea of killing. So the Arusha, for me, symbolically, it is good to say that, okay, we did something, but it is not enough.
Tell me what you can about the present condition of your siblings. Your brothers and your sister, where are they now and what are they doing?
In Canada, I am with my young sister. He's in the beginning of her studies in the University of Ottawa too. My brother, which came after me, is in Rwanda. He's just in the beginning of his work after a degree in accounting. Other is just working in a private sector, and the three others are at school, and I have another sister who is somewhere at a small work. Catherine has a question.
Hi, Bert.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could say a little something about the gachacha process and whether you have testified in any of those.
No, I keep out. You know.
Could you explain maybe to people what the gachacha process is about? And
Alex, can you go? I don't like gachacha too much.
So the issue was how do you, as Bert said, how are you going to put on trial 1 million or 500,000 people? So the Rwandan government came up with an alternative system since they wanted to implement reconciliatory justice and not punitive justice. And so the government opted to create local courts throughout all the country and where people were going to come forward and were mandated to say, to tell what they saw. And then certain people who were then accused of being perpetrators were brought in front of those gachachas. And then... either they could confess or denial. If they confessed, they got a reduction in their sentencing, about half of their prison term. And if they refused to confess or didn't say all the truth and it was found out that they were guilty, so then they were put into jail. At the same time, the gachacha were not originally meant to judge those kind of crimes. Those were reconciliatory tribunals to litigate issues of theft or of property of those nature, not of crime. But so the government thought that was one way to try to get some part of the stories out within the various communities. So the views about the gachachas are very diverse because here, you know, it's like survivors' trajectories that you underlined. Some people find some form of closure if they learn where the remains of parents are. So that's one of the hopes that many survivors try to seek through Gacaca, more than the implementation of justice per se, because what is 10 years of prison in comparison of the crime that has been committed? And then the other main issue surrounding Gacaca is the issue of compensation for victims. So maybe, would you like to say something?
Yeah, I can try. Yeah, in the process of reconciliation, it is just because for me it is a reconciliation, forgiveness after a genocide without justice. It is too much for me. That is why I didn't know what is going on. In my family, I remember when I was in Rwanda in 2005, my brother told me that people who stayed there we were during, before and during the genocide asked him to come and to participate. And before he went there, people were saying, oh, we didn't know those people you are saying, you are talking about, and it is about my parents. And when he went there, they begin to say, "Ah, Rory, oh, there is someone from Alexi." My parents, my dad was called Alexi. Oh, there is a child for Alex. Ah, I remember. Ah, but before they denied. Oh, we do know those people you are talking about, and I was very angry with that. Now they killed them, and now they are saying they never existed. That is something about Gacaca. Some survivors, maybe now the number is 150, were killed because of testifying, because that killers knows that you are a survivor, and you saw me when I was killing. So there are some cases where survivors are persecuted, not only survivors, also some who want to say the truth, sometimes they are persecuted. So it is not really a secure process. But at the same time, truth has to get out if people have to be together. As I was saying in afternoon with students, for survivors, we want to know. I was saying that I don't know where my sisters are. I don't know where my cousins are. If it is somewhere in toilet, is somewhere, I don't know. And in Gacaca, what is somehow positive, some survivors can know, oh, my child is somewhere. I'm going to put it out and give him or her a dignity. That can be positive. But other survivors has to, you know, you survived and you have to go in front of people for saying what was going on during the genocide. In front of killers who have more truth than you, because sometimes you had to be hidden, you don't know all what was going on. And also, in other hand, killers has to stand up and say, do you know what I did in genocide? I cut your mom and I put her somewhere. It is me who killed your children. In this day, I killed 5 people. I don't know if it is helpful for the killer too, to go in front of people and say how he killed. So it is, for me, a very complicated situation, and I chose to not be in any church. But I understand also the approach of the government. It is a government who has to manage killers, victims, and yeah.
I'm just wondering how you feel about the movie Hotel Rwanda and just how that showed the genocide, just you having written your book and probably having a different perspective.
About? I don't understand.
Do you know the film Hotel Rwanda? It's popular in the United States.
Hotel Rwanda, oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Just because it may not be completely accurate, but that's what so many people have seen and just connect directly to what exactly happened when that may not have been the case.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there are many differences and big differences. The book is from a survivor. The film is about a man who tried to save people. And the film is good because it shows some reality of a genocide. But at the other hand, I'm not sure if the hero of the film did or what the film showed. Yeah, there are different critics about the hero of the film, but the film in itself, it shows the reality of a genocide. And I know in America, it has a good success, and there are some kind of reality which is going on now, which is get out. So, yeah, that is what I can say.
Will the main Kigali connection continue, and how?
Sorry?
The main Kigali connection,
mm-hmm.
Will it continue?
And oh, I hope so. maybe the question is not for me. Yeah? Only, yeah, for me too, but not only. Yeah, there is another question.
Yeah, so I have so much interest in peace restoration, most in post-conflict nations. And one of my concerns is that I thought you may talk more about Gachacha, which I'm much knowledgeable about. But since now you don't seem to be part of it, and what are some of the alternatives that yourself think could bring Rwanda together, and some of the future maybe speculations that you may have, what are your personal alternatives of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very challenging question. I think the first thing, it is not to choose the easy way. And the easy way is which one? After a genocide or after a conflict. I think people want to talk about a dialogue of peace very quickly without taking in account all the consequences of the conflict or after a genocide, how to talk about peace without justice. And how to talk about reconciliation without truth. So, all what we do right now, I think they are most diplomatic things. Because of the world has to continue to function, people choose easy ways. But I think in the same time, those easy ways is what not they are not help. I think it is why it is what Holocaust, Armenian genocide, Rwanda, Cambodia, now Darfur. If we choose the difficult ways, the future maybe can be other. But, you know, it is very easy to say peace. It is a good word. It is very nice to say we have to have a dialogue. But it is very difficult to say we have to punish some people. We have to give justice to others. You know, it is not only also for kinds of genocide. They are in very many countries. Children are abused in some different areas by educators, by parents, and when the parent or someone else didn't recognize what he did to the kids, how do you want that the kid will go forward? It is just a simple example in the ordinary life. And then how, when we have to consider a genocide. So for me, I have some other interest in life, and I try to be peaceful with people, and I just try to be connected with reality. Yeah, that is what I can say.
You are speaking to an audience that hears you and cares, I suspect, quite deeply about the pain of that lost generation, that sacrificed generation. What can we, an audience, members of an audience, do to make things better for that generation?
I think I'm not a good advisor. Oh my God, it is really very difficult. Yeah, but you are doing things. You are now in front of me and you took your time just for being with me. So you are doing something. I think I experienced the genocide. And now I'm trying to do something with it. So I think in a big way, it is also for everyone to choose what to do. I think that when Alexandre came the first time in Rwanda, he came back in U.S. with the project for helping orphans in my village. Someone else can, I know some other people who choose to go in Rwanda, to stay there, to collect testimonies. It is a very good idea too. Those voices are there to tell the story. To tell and tell the story to the world. So maybe it depends on the situation of everyone. It is not easy for me to give advice, but I can advise from an idea.
Yeah. So maybe since my name was mentioned, so I'm going to do two things. So the first one is also regarding the main Kigali connection. So the students who came back from Rwanda, So they are part of an association here on campus called Bates Students for Peace in Rwanda. And they try to do fundraising to pay maybe for one orphan that they visited in May a scholarship so that they can also have a chance to study, because that may be one venue for survivors who are orphans to rebuild some themselves. So you will recognize some of them because they have traditional dresses here, and they will be at the exit, and they are selling little postcards that were made by street children in Rwanda, or you can just throw a little bit of money in the peace basket that is over there and ask them questions about their own experience. So that's also one way that we can act here. And then the second thing I would like to say is thank you very much for being here, for having taken the time to listen to Bert's story. And please feel free to continue the conversation with her here. And thank you very much, Bert. And I'm going to pass the mic to David Scobie for the closing remarks.
Well, I just want to say a quick thank you, especially to Bert and to Alex. You have been so eloquent in connecting with us, and it will, speaking only for myself, it will stay with me. And if I can move to business, if you spoke, and many of you did, for which many, many thanks, before you leave, please come and just sign the consent form so that we can post this the video of this on our website and also broadcast it. But most importantly, let's thank Bert.